Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The Man Team.
Mega Bears Fan.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Polycast episode 351, also known as Hopefully We Didn't Screw It Up This Time As Bad As We Did Last Time. Today,
What did we screw up last time?
It was mostly me because I haven't actually released episode 350 yet because I've been, you know, not doing well, but it'll be out later today, the recording day, which is December 14th. But anyway, this is Canis Albinus, and we're joined with our full crew of Makalua.
With my full cup of coffee.
The Mian Team.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Mega Bears Fan.
Coffee is evil. I do chocolate milk.
Yum. Although I'm trying to lose weight, not gain weight. But
coffee's evil, huh?
Evil?
Did you just declare war on Mackey?
I don't know. I think we're going to have to nail him for that. I see the potential of putting your chocolate milk in the coffee, because then you have a mocha.
Coffee is evil because it enables employers to think it's acceptable to wake us up at 7 in the morning.
That's not the coffee's fault.
Darn it.
That sounded like Mad Jen for a moment there. But I don't think he would denounce coffee, so.
No.
Okay. I don't really drink coffee anymore either.
Okay, so today we're going to do something a little bit different. This show is not really aimed at our regular listeners, so if you're a regular listener who is a very strong player of this game, it will probably not be very interesting to you, but I have received at least 3 different messages from people, specifically from, let's see if I can find their names. Zach Smith is one who sent me a message on Twitter, and then a couple of people who sent emails that I can't get to the email right now because I'm too overlogged with Windows to get to it. But basically the idea was, hey, can you do like a primer show based on all the stuff that those of us who play on consoles who have never even heard of Civ before might actually be able to understand what you guys are talking about on the forums? And I thought, that's a good idea. And since this is the last show before the end of the season and the end of the year, we might as well do that. So we have some general ideas on what to talk about, so let's let whoever wants to start.
Well, before we go, I just want to say that it's awesome that people who, I guess, have not even played the game yet are finding the show and, giving us feedback and doing topic requests. That's awesome. So I hope all these people who sent you messages become regular listeners.
I do as well. You're all welcome here, even if you don't like us.
Almost especially if you don't like us, because if you're still listening to us and you don't like us, we must be doing something right.
Yeah. So the most basic things, we will avoid the most obvious click this button to do this, because hopefully if you're smart enough to have found our podcast, since it is not exactly the most easily findable thing, that you are at least competent enough to know how to click a button.
And besides, if this is intended for the console players, none of us, I think, is actually playing the game on consoles. We're all PC players, so we don't even know what buttons you press on the console controllers to do things. So
the buttons aren't that hard. I've played it on the Switch, and it's pretty easy to figure out as long as you recognize that you have to use the arrow keys sometimes, or the arrow buttons. Because otherwise it'll just do the first thing on the list, and that sometimes doesn't go well. But alright, most basic thing in Civ, the thing you want to do is win the game. And the way you win the game is by killing everybody else, almost exclusively. Other ways you can win, you can build a spaceship and go to Alpha Centauri, although that is a more difficult thing to do if you are in a game full of particularly aggressive AIs, which is usually all of them on a higher level difficulty. You can also win by religious victory, although that is a little bit more difficult and a little more nuanced as to how you move your units around and produce your faith.
It's also the only victory that you can explicitly get locked out of completing by relatively early in the game, because if you do not found a religion, you are ineligible for the religious victory. Even if you conquer someone else's holy city, you still can't win a religious victory using their religion. So if you didn't found it, don't even worry about trying to get that victory. It's also not possible.
Congo cannot ever found a religion, so they don't get to participate in that victory at all.
And correct. You have to watch out for the AI spreading its religion to you and everybody else and trying to win it themselves. Because we've even had our multiplayer turncast games ended because an AI did religious victory.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, it's funny to watch Dan lose that way.
It happened once, and then he turned it off forever.
Yep.
And the religious victory is something that especially if you didn't found a religion and you're not playing religiously at all, it is very easy for another player or an AI to just slip that victory in under the radar without like you even really noticing it's happening. Because the game doesn't give you much in the way of notifications that a player is getting close to that victory. They tell you in other civs have captured capitals. But with the religious victory, you kind of just have to keep checking up on that yourself. If you see another civ that's getting like 2, 3, 4, depending on how many civs are in the game, civs converted, you definitely need to start doing something about it. Either you have to conquer them or you need to start aggressively spreading a different religion in order to hold them off long enough for you to get to your own victory.
One thing I would broadly advocate, and this is for 4X in general, but especially for Civ because it has multiple, is to keep your eye on victory conditions throughout the game, because ultimately that is the win condition, literally speaking. Yeah, so that's what you meet to end the game. And if you go to the religion screen, you will see how many AIs or how many of your opponents have been converted to a particular religion, and who is leading as a result of that. And checking that can be the difference between winning and losing, because it can inform your planning, but that will also tell you about the other victory conditions if you switch to those.
Tabs, yeah.
Yeah. And you do want to know if somebody's like leading really by a lot in science or military or anything else. Like it could affect who your next targets are if you're fighting, or just let you know how you stack up against AI, if you have to change your plan or not, if you're going to lose with your current track.
Also,
you've got the handy report up there that even splits it down into each religion and how close they are, or not each religion, each victory and how close they are. So you can see somebody creeping along, you know, quietly creeping along in the science victory and go, I've got to knock them down a little bit.
Also, yeah, remember,
if you're fighting and they're up like 10 techs on you, you might want to kill them now rather than later before they get too far.
We'll talk about war in a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, that's something you want to check constantly, no matter what your victory condition is, because it can inform your choices enough to make it worth checking a lot.
And if you do have to take action against another civilization in the game, it is generally best to do that earlier rather than later, because this game has a lot of what's called snowballing, which means basically that people who are already ahead tend to get even further ahead, and the civs who are already behind tend to fall even further behind. So if someone already has a tech lead on you, don't wait around to think you're going to tech up to catch up to them, because you're probably not. You're going to have to just go for it, you know, overwhelm them with more stuff. And yeah, we'll get to more of that on when we actually talk about warfare.
Actually, snowballing is not a bad place to start if for a 4X primer in the first place.
Yeah.
If you, what are the 4Xs again?
Expand,
explore, exploit, expand,
exploit, exterminate, and exterminate.
So that's something to keep in mind. The bigger you are, or the stronger your position already is, the more capable you are of strengthening your position further. So in 4Xs in general, you want to increase your power curve as quickly as possible. And sometimes that does mean doing things that might be unintuitive to a beginner. For example, chopping is considered very strong in Civ 6. And while we don't need to go into the nuance of that, the reason that's considered so strong is it's giving you a benefit immediately rather than delaying it into the future. And because you're getting that benefit immediately, even though the aggregate total value of that singular decision is smaller, it's pushing your setup ahead earlier in the game, and that's worth more.
And of course, when he says chopping, what he means is cutting down forests or jungles or harvesting correct. Resources.
Yes, any of that would fall under that category. And it's very often the case that lump sum bonuses in the game are more valuable. than long, like, overturn bonuses. It's not always true, and you can do math on it, but a lot of people just don't factor present value enough when it comes to the rate at which their civilization strengthens, or the rate at which their empire and other forex strengthen.
These types of games are sort of light economy simulators in that sense. You have to think where your brain is, where your system wants to go, in order to get the best out of it. And sometimes that does require forward thinking, because it is a strategy game.
Yeah, but I would actually err on the side of taking immediate benefit in Forex, typically.
Yes, getting stuff now is generally better than getting stuff later.
You use the chop, you build a library in your campus, whatever turn, and you're getting that science from it so many turns earlier, and then as you keep going, that snowballs into you having techs earlier, and then being ahead of the other AIs or other players, and then you have a stronger army, and you're more likely to hit all of your victory, whatever victory condition you're going for.
And another thing I would like to mention is, if you are someone who is coming from Civilization 5, and for whatever reason you decided to jump to consoles and are going to Civilization 6, Civ 6 is much more of a builder's game than Civ 5 was. Civ 5, the best strategies often were keeping just a few cities, what was it, like 4 or 5, and going down like the tradition tree and stuff like
most
that.
Most common was 4-city tradition. That was the most common in it.
But in Civ 6, a lot of those global penalties to like number of cities and population, they're just all gone. And you can build pretty much as many cities as you care to build and want to manage in this game. So if there's a resource that you need, go ahead and settle a city near it. And the more cities you have generally in this game, the more stuff you are getting, the more yields, the more resources, it's the more places you have to build units. And to build infrastructure and to build commercial hubs and stuff to get more trade routes. So generally, building more stuff in this game is better.
Yeah, as much as we love to mock the AI sometimes for building a crap city down in the tundra, if that's where your only uranium or oil is in the later areas of the game, it's a perfectly good city.
There were two other victory conditions we didn't mention earlier. There's the culture victory condition, which, to be very frank with everybody in the room, I still don't know how it works, and I've played this game for 3 years. It's not exactly very clear how the tourism system works, other than make lots of culture to not get beaten by culture victory, and make lots of tourism to win culture victory.
Yeah, this is
probably a good time to mention external resources while playing. I mean, we are one of them, but we're certainly not the only one. And it's very helpful to have like the wiki up, as long as it's accurate, or Civ Fanatics forums or other sources like that while playing, so you can check how these mechanics work, because it isn't always clear in the game. It should be clear. That's one of my most common criticisms of the game. But since it isn't, definitely take advantage of any resource you can get your hands on for learning how some of these mechanics work under the hood, or at least enough that you can make informed decisions about them rather than guessing, okay, well, how do I win culture? I mean, I guess I broadly need to produce tourism and prevent the other person from making culture, but you just don't get enough information from that in the game. And you can get a lot of detail on this if you read through forum threads on it, for example, or wherever else you prefer to find the information.
Yeah, I would say that the basics of, building theater squares and producing great artists and writers and musicians and then making great works to generate tourism, that's, I think, pretty self-explanatory. The real confusion with the culture victory is how exactly all the counterplay works, because it's not entirely clear how culture defends you from tourism and like even how the tourism spreads and disseminates across the world. So... but the basic gist is building great works and wonders and getting tourism from them and overwhelming the other players with lots and lots of tourism.
The final victory condition is brand new and only present in the Gathering Storm expansion. That is the diplomatic victory. And for a beginner, I would suggest that you avoid that condition until you are more nuanced and understand the game better, because even those of us who have played the game for a long time have a lot of difficulty with this condition. So
a lot of it comes down to predicting the AI too, which
you really need experience.
By definition, you need experience.
Yeah, you need lots of experience to be able to figure out what the AI is going to do. And even then, you don't always get it right.
Frequently, you don't get it right because the AI just goes off on some strange tangent, and you're like, okay.
Yeah, and a lot of the points that you get towards the diplomatic victory come from fulfilling the little emergency, like, quote-unquote quests, I guess would be a good way to describe them. Little quests that you get to go liberate a city or something like that. And yeah, if you're a inexperienced player, like, resolving those can actually be quite challenging. So, you know, you do want to be careful about accepting those quests until you are more comfortable with the game and you know how to find another player's capital or a specific city and, you know, how to actually properly capture such a specific target. Because otherwise you're just going to be giving, you know, failing the quest and giving your opponent advantages.
Yeah, and even we underestimate that sometimes, because if they're not close to you and you think, oh, well, I can just punch through to that, sometimes to their capital, you know, through some of their other territory, sometimes you can't, because there's other mechanics we'll get into later that makes trying to hold cities a pain in the rear.
Or it's just getting across the map. Like, for example, if you have to go liberate a city-state and it's on another continent halfway across the map, you know, there's a turn time limit before you have to complete this goal. And sometimes, like, half of that time is just taken up sailing your units across the ocean to just get to the place.
Yes.
Yeah, if they're not relatively close, you might want to just pass on that emergency.
Also, go ahead.
There is, I was just going to mention, there is also one more victory condition, which is the timeout / score victory, which is just that the game ends after a certain number of turns, and whoever has the most points wins the game, and points generally come from your number of cities and population and the number of wonders that you've built.
Score victory is generally considered you won mostly, but if you didn't complete a victory condition other than that, it's not generally a goal that one would consider a good one. Usually that's the default, oh, you didn't lose condition. Really something to brag about.
As you increase difficulty, you will not be able to win it normally, because somebody will win before you run out of turns. But for lower difficulties, you can win that way. It's just, it's ideal to try to win one of the other victory conditions for that.
Next up, should we talk about unit movement?
Because I think that's good. I would also suggest maybe going through some of the early game things like exploration and dealing with barbarians and stuff like that would also be a good place to. But unit movement is good as well.
Well, unit movement is more complicated in Civ 6 than it is in most other 4X games. Specifically because for Civilization 6 uses the terrain as a barrier to your transit. In most games, you move one tile and you can move to the next tile if you have a fraction of a movement point. In Civ 6, you have to have a full movement point to move anywhere, which means if you only have, if you move by a road, which takes a fraction of a movement point, and then try to move off the road without a full movement point, you will not be able to do it.
Well, this minor correction, you have to have as many movement points as it requires to enter the terrain you're going onto. So if it costs 2 or 3 movement points to enter that terrain because there's a hill and a forest on it, you have to have 2 or 3 movement points left. You can't just move onto it with just 1 point left.
Which makes it a little bit more difficult for people who aren't used to that kind of thing.
Right. The only exception being if your unit still has all of its movement, you can always move onto an adjacent tile with 1 movement point. You're not going to get into a situation where you're like stuck in between a bunch of hill forests and your unit only has 2 movement and it's literally impossible to move it out. That will not happen.
Crossing rivers always drains your movement points.
Yeah. Until you've got roads.
Well, not roads, bridges.
Right. Bridges across the river.
Crossing rivers. Also not the greatest idea to cross a river to attack something.
Yeah.
They are, roads in general are weaker than previous versions, but they do offset terrain. Yeah, so in that context, they can be quite valuable.
The later in the game you get, the better the roads are.
Until we start talking railroads.
Well, yeah, at least the roads automatically improve as you go through eras and stuff, but when you get to railroads, you're going to have to build those yourself.
Yep.
Oh, and roads in this game are, again, a little bit different from previous Civ games, and also most games with roads, in that you don't choose to place them normally, but rather they form as a result of trade routes, typically. I think you can build them with that military engineer, but
that's pretty late on.
Yeah, it's pretty late in the game, and it's needlessly expensive in production, so it's not a realistic option. And so you're mostly going to be using trade routes to make roads.
Yeah, every individual military engineer can only build, I think it's like 2 or 3 tiles of road, and then he's spent. And yeah, it's just almost always not worth doing, unless you have some really, really strong need for a road somewhere.
You would use that in a situation where you need a road to your own harbor, as opposed to another city, because you need at least 2 to get to another city, and that's if the cities are very close to each other.
Yeah, or maybe building a road into like a choke point where a conflict is going on and you need to rapidly like move units onto or out of the front line to reinforce and heal. And there's a bunch of like hills and forests in the way that are blocking your movement. Then you might want to build a few tiles of road in order to just get your units back and forth.
Definitely true.
And there's everybody's favorite tunnels through the mountains, even though that is somewhat later on, but it's still nice.
Unless you're the Inca, and it's also only in Gathering Storm.
Yeah, that's true. That is only Gathering Storm.
Because we are kind of ignoring the fact that the expansions are kind of expensive on the consoles, so some people may not have bought them. But as people who have played the game, we highly recommend that you buy the expansions because they make the game much better. And not like $10 DLC, ooh, you got an extra weapon better. Like, holy crap, this is a whole new game, way more expansion-based game.
No, not entirely changing the gameplay, but adding more good things to the gameplay and adding more things for you to do. Like, Diplomatic Victory is only a Gathering Storm thing. We haven't had that before, which is why we're still kind of, how we do this again?
Yeah, we'll probably get into more of the expansion stuff in future episodes, since this one will probably be focused on the vanilla game. Are the expansions even out yet on consoles?
They're out on the Switch as well.
Okay, so let's
talk about Barbarians. Barbarians are that early game scourge that even advanced players hate.
They can be very nasty in Civ 6, especially compared to previous entries in the series.
Yeah, and they will very easily wreck your face if you are not prepared for them.
Yeah, what they are optional. You can turn them on and off. But if you're going to leave them on, that means some of your early build stuff should definitely be military units. I mean, I know because having more cities is better and you want to get your settlers out sooner, but you've got to have at least 2 or 3 to handle those guys. And one of those guys' job is going to be escorting your settlers so they don't get sniped by the barbarians.
And personally,
let's put it this way. More cities is good, but if you don't do something about the barbarians, you're probably going to struggle to actually get more cities. And it doesn't hurt to have military units also, because your enemies might decide that your cities are also good for them.
Yeah, they might decide you look like a tasty target.
Military is not something you want to ignore.
Yeah, I would definitely say that leaving barbarians on, even as a new player, is actually, I think, a very good idea, because you do want to build military units early in the game regardless, and having the barbarians there to kind of poke and prod and push you towards building military units will teach and reinforce, you know, what are good strategies in general. Because you want to make sure that you can defend yourself not only from barbarians, but from aggressive civilizations like Montezuma and Alexander and, you know,
Shaka.
Yeah, Shaka, if you have the expansions. Because if you have a tiny army, almost any civilization in the game, no matter how peaceful they might seem, will turn on you at the drop of a hat when they sense weakness and might start capturing your cities because you don't have any units to defend them.
And if you don't have units to defend them, they probably will capture your cities eventually.
Yeah.
The way the barbs work, they have a camp, and these camps spawn randomly in the world on game start, and every time one is destroyed, another one spawns somewhere else on the planet. And these barbarian camps start out with a single scout unit. And when these units find a civilization, they'll get a little exclamation point above their head, which means, hey, we've noticed something. They'll go back to their camp and tell them, hey, guys, there's a civ over here. We should raid it. And then the camp will start producing units slowly, or faster than it probably should, to create a raiding party. And they will send the raiding party to the city and try to capture it.
Yeah, if you don't have very many units of your own, it definitely does not feel like they're producing those units slowly. It feels pretty dang fast. So you definitely want to have your units built before that happens, and you will get a notification in the corner or side of the screen that will tell you when a barbarian scout has found one of your cities, and you should be able to, hopefully, I guess on the consoles, click on it or press on it, and it should hopefully take you to where that's happening so you can see. And if you can actually catch that scout and kill it before it gets back to the barbarian outpost, then you will save yourself from having to fight a horde of barbarians coming out of that outpost.
Also be warned, if there is a horse unit anywhere within 5 tiles of the camp, it will send horses after you.
Yeah, if you see that resource tile, it's bad news.
And those horses, while in the early game they'll only be half strength, once they've made enough of them, they will become full strength. And those full strength horse units are much stronger than just about anything you can produce without any tech. Which means you're in trouble if you let that happen. So don't let the barbs get away.
Right, which I think brings me to something that I recommend doing, and I don't know if the other players here will agree with me when it comes to exploration, which is to keep your early units close to your city. So that first warrior that you're going to start with, when you're exploring with him, you should generally try to stay on open terrain so he can move as many spaces as possible and reveal as many tiles as possible. But I also recommend that you kind of like spiral him out in, you know, enlarging circles as you go, so that he's always at the closest distance possible to getting back to your city in case barbarians or an aggressive civilization do show up and you need to defend yourself. Don't just send your starting warrior out in a straight line, you know, for 20, 30, 50 tiles. And then suddenly a conflict breaks out and you have no units because your guy is halfway across the continent.
I agree, but for different reasons. If you move your warrior one direction, it's almost impossible early on in Civ 6, and this is one of my criticisms of the barb system, to then block a scout from just making the barbs attack you. So it's not realistic for new players or even total pros to prevent early game getting scouted. You just can't produce enough units in time to do to interrupt the scouts. You can eventually have enough to interrupt it, but not in the first 10-15 turns. But the reason you want to scout around your immediate surroundings is that you do want to know where to place your cities and where you can place your cities. If you don't see the terrain, you don't see good sites. So that's one of your most crucial early decision points. You want to see them, and helping against the barbs is a nice bonus on top of that. To have something close by, you can at least clean up. You do want to produce enough units. And the other nice thing, or the other thing I would suggest you do with early game units, is that once you have scouted your immediate surroundings and you've begun to scout the AIs and whatnot, you want to leave screens. And by screens, I mean cheap units that don't cost maintenance, that see stuff. Because you can then see barb scouts incoming, and you can see AI attackers incoming long before they declare war. There have been quite a few player deaths on a turncast games where they got blindsided by the AI, where this tiny investment would have completely prevented them dying to the AI or getting roughed up a lot by a surprise attack, because they would have seen the 5 to 10 to 15 units coming their way like as maybe as many as 10 turns earlier, but certainly at least 5 plus, and well, given the time to produce units and move units to defend themselves, it's very useful for the cost.
To be fair, that's happened to everybody.
Yeah,
it's not happened to everybody. I've never died that way in Civ 6.
And when you're squished in with other AI or other human players on the map, sometimes you're not sure who the AI is going after. You see it, but you don't think it's coming after you.
They're pretty predictable in their movements if you have something immediately between them and you.
I've seen them declare on the screen units before.
That's fine. Like, they're not taking your city. They're taking your screen then.
Oh no, yeah, you killed my scout.
Right, if they kill a scout or a warrior, you know, big deal, assuming you have more, you know, behind it to take its place.
Yeah, now they're not moving, like, 3 units surrounding your first city already. Now you have time to produce or at least move units that will block them from actually putting your city under siege.
Yeah, and another benefit of having a lot of screen units around the perimeter of your early civilization is that barbarians literally cannot spawn in places where any civilization has visibility on the map. So if you have a unit, you know, if you have your territory completely surrounded by units that are providing visibility, then the barbarians cannot spawn like right up next to your civilization. They would have to spawn out in the place where you and no one else can see.
Specifically, the game won't place a camp in view if it doesn't already exist. Yeah.
True. The barbarians can still wander into places where you have visibility, obviously, but their little camps will not spawn in places that any player can currently see. Of course, that doesn't mean that if you move your unit for any reason, a barbarian camp won't spawn there the next turn. I've had that happen.
The very next turn, boom! Yeah, every time, I swear.
Well, at least it won't be hard to find it.
True.
Any other tips or tricks for dealing with barbarians or for early exploration with your, or just generally moving your units around?
City placement?
Yeah, do we want to do city placement or maybe early build orders? Do we want to talk about build orders?
Let's do city placement
first.
What
you can build?
I mean, the broad idea for build orders early in the game is you want to expand as much as possible within your constraints. So there'll be things that interrupt your expansion, such as barbarians or hostile players or just insufficient amounts of land.
And at least
or the land is really terrible before you get technologies. So yeah. Your broad goal is to expand as much as possible, but that as much as possible is contingent on your scenario.
And you probably do want at least one of the early cities to be a science city so you can get all those technologies. Because if you sit there and just spam out and you're... Even though your capital produces an okay amount of science to start with, you're going to start falling behind if you don't start raising that, you know.
Although there are different play styles, I usually don't give a crap if I start falling behind a little bit if I'm doing military stuff.
Well,
but it's the expansion that really makes a difference. Well, I'm just saying, you can win on the highest difficulties that way still. It would probably be hard against elite human players, but for a beginner guide, you just want to get to the point where you're out expanding the AI and able to beat it. I don't want, what I want to prevent is having somebody like invest heavily in science early and get killed.
No.
That's a very common beginner mistake in any Civ game.
Yeah, that's like I'm thinking you like get three or four cities outside of your capital out, and then either you, and hopefully one of those places is a good science place if your capital wasn't, and then you get at least just one campus down. You don't have to go through all cities, but you need to get something going.
Yeah, and we're talking about, like, you know, 50 to 100 turns into the game. You know, we're not trying to say, you know, Maki's not trying to say that you should have, like turn five, you need to be building a settler and looking for a place to build a city and a campus and all that stuff. This is, you know, tens of turns into the game that you start thinking about stuff like that. Again, early in the game, you definitely want to be focusing on units just to defend yourself because barbarians and other players are so aggressive.
Well, settlers are units, though, and as soon as you can get away with them, you should probably be making them.
Oh, yeah, especially if there is just a really great place for you to put a city, and especially if there's other civilizations that are really close to you, because they will be competitive for those places, and they will put their cities in crappy locations that are not worth conquering, but that block you from putting your own cities in the better place that's two or three tiles away. So, yeah, there's that.
I'd say you want the cities anyway.
Yeah.
Regardless, regardless of those considerations, because like, what's driving your victory conditions, even military, but any of the victory conditions, is the yield you're getting from your cities. And if you do the math on the yields, getting more cities earlier, like settling more cities, you start to see pretty big spikes in production, science, everything. So you want to get those down. The only reason you're building military units is that if you don't, your ability to expand and improve your empire strength through growing cities and putting new cities down / conquering cities is impaired to the point where you are better off building the military units than you are building the cities. But if you could build the cities, just don't lose your settler to barbarians or get yourself conquered.
Right, or put your city in a place where you just cannot defend it.
Yes, yeah, so that would be getting yourself conquered.
As far as
probably
as far as city placement goes, rivers are good, coasts are not so good, although being within range of the coast so you can build a harbor is okay.
For a beginner player, the game does give you tips on where to put cities when you have the settler selected. Do we think that those are worth doing for beginner players, or should we recommend that beginner players just completely ignore them and pick your own?
I would recommend they start immediately thinking about why a city is good versus not. The suggestions can be a little loopy, and it can lead you astray a little bit in terms of what makes a good city.
I would say at the very least, look at the tiles that are highlighted green. Those are probably almost certainly
you want
the
fresh
places
water.
Where you want, yeah, where you want to put your cities. But the game will highlight like specific tiles like within a certain distance of your settler, and it's not really the best at picking good spots, so you might want to ignore those and, you know, look at the actual yields and resources and terrain and pick a spot yourself.
Because you'll still have that green highlight on a river that's out in the middle of the plains or the tundra just because it's fresh water. But if you're up that high or into that, there might not be any good food resources, and that city might be stunted the entire game. You would rather come back in closer to a grasslands area where that city can grow a lot, especially if there's food resources, or if you're, you know, later on, if you're looking for some of the strategic resources, like you're a little bit, there's some iron just a little bit outside your borders. And even if that's not a freshwater city, you might want to get up there and get that iron.
Right. But your first like two or three cities, you should definitely be looking at making sure that there's a lot of food, decent production, and at least a few resources within that two or three tile radius around where you're going
to... Yeah, especially luxuries to keep the city happy, because that's going to... As the city gets bigger, you're going to need that.
Right. Putting cities on top of hills is generally a good idea. It provides a defensive bonus, and usually, if it's a plains hill, will give the underlying city tile an extra production for the entire game that you don't even have to work that tile. So if you can put a city on a plains hill, especially adjacent to a river or lake, that is generally the best spot for a city, assuming that the tiles around it are also, you know, decent. Also, don't be afraid to settle on top of luxury and strategic resources.
Yeah, you still get them.
In previous games, they would disappear if you put a city on top of them. And I think that, I don't know about the other players here, but for me, that kind of taught and reinforced, you know, bad behaviors for me, because now even in Civ 6, I often forget that I can put cities on top of luxuries, and I don't, even though that would give me better yield. Because if you put a city on top of a luxury, you immediately get the benefits of that luxury. And your city also automatically gets some of the yield from that luxury. So you don't even have to work the tile. You don't have to use a builder to improve it. You immediately get the benefits, and without having to, you know, work the tile with your population. And that's always a good thing. Getting more yields sooner is better than getting yields later.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing to do if it's not a bad behavior if it was a behavior that was good before the new game.
It's just hard to break old habits sometimes.
Yeah. I'm an old dog. Sometimes it's hard for these games to teach me new tricks.
I'm a slightly less old dog, but I still don't know any tricks.
I'm just thinking it's funny to say that the barbs are the most brutal in Civ 6.
I don't know if they're the most brutal. But
well,
the most
they can't
annoying.
Take over cities anymore, but on the pain in the ass scale, they're pretty high.
I was
certainly annoying. I just remember in games where you could straight up die to them very easily in Civ.
I was mostly talking about as compared to Civ 5. I feel like the barbs in Civ 6 are a lot more difficult to deal with and a lot more threatening. But yes, you're right. In Civ 3, they could literally just walk into your city and capture it and burn it to the ground.
Yeah, Civ 4 too.
The Vitagarian event. You lose!
Even without that, though, like on high difficulties, they would come for you early, and they were existential threats. They weren't just going to set you back. You could literally just lose the game on the spot to them if you are not playing.
I think on the highest difficulties in Civ 6, they can capture and raise your cities, but I think you have to be on like the top one or two difficulty levels.
I've never had it happen on Deity. I mean, I don't let them just wail on my cities for free to see what happens either, though.
Right, but I think the rules actually do allow them to do that at the higher difficulty, because the barbarians' behaviors will change based on the difficulty level you select. So they will get more aggressive, and they will do more things.
Did not know that.
Yeah, I think on what's the difficulty level right below Deity? Is it Emperor Immortal?
Immortal.
I think it's starting at Immortal. The barbarians are allowed to capture cities. I think it's on the wiki. I think it was on the wiki. I don't know. Maybe I should double check. Maybe I'm wrong.
I thought they always could. It was just a threat on the higher difficulties, but it might not be right. I don't know.
So we should talk about districts?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to go after talking about city locations.
Always build the districts that are the best for you. The way you decide that is Usually food, or usually the gold district is good because it gives you trade routes and it gives you money. Science, you need science. At least one of, because you want more science.
I would prioritize campuses over money, in at least since like early vanilla.
Yeah, the money is good to support an army and stuff, but if you don't have the technology to make a decently advanced army, you're still going to get raffle stomped. I mean, you could have like a dozen units of a lower tech, but somebody comes through with half as many or less in a higher tech, and you can just get rolled right over, you know?
I guess with I should some have said exceptions. In no particular order.
Yeah.
For example, if you invested in a camp, in a, what's it, in an encampment, and have a great general boosting your army, and some unit experience, possibly even cores and armies later in the game, that's less true, and you can start actually killing stuff from more advanced eras without losing units pretty routinely. So there's, it's tough to say in a vacuum which district is the best, because science is useful, culture is useful, gold is useful, better military units are useful, and you will get at least one of these things from most of the regular districts. So unless we're talking about something more niche, like, what is it?
Aqueducts
or something, or entertainment. A lot of the standard districts are pretty good in the right context. And they also scale awkwardly in cost, which means that like it costs more to build a district you already have a lot of rather than one that you haven't built yet. So now not only does that fifth campus need to be better than your alternative choices, but it needs to be better by more than the cost as well to justify it at that stage. So depending on what you're trying to do, it may or may not be worth building anymore. So it's not so easy to choose what the best district is. I would say let your strategy short and long term guide your district choices to some degree. But keep in mind that some things you need right now will get you there faster, even if it seems off path. Like some science will still help you get culture more quickly.
And in general, you don't want to fall too far behind in any category. So it is a good idea to build a diverse set of districts so that you are getting a little bit of everything. You know, you don't want to like completely neglect building theater squares because it might not seem like it immediately, but getting culture is pretty dang important.
That's how you get civics.
Yeah, and a lot of useful policy cards, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the tree that gives you, say, corps and armies. So even if you're a military person, it's pretty useful to be producing culture. Enough that you would probably do want to invest in those. You can get by not doing it, but it makes it harder than if you just make a couple.
I mean, yeah, at least having like one or two, you know, put one down in one of your early cities, you know, when you're able to. You don't necessarily have to rush for it. I'm not saying you have to build one in every single city. But, you know, if you've got four or five cities, you probably should have at least one copy of every, you know, district.
Another important consideration here is the value of the district based on adjacency bonuses. So the terrain itself will dictate how strong a district is in a given place. And you might prefer something that's significantly stronger, especially if like a doubling district policy card already. You might prefer to place a district that would otherwise not be your top choice, depending on that.
Just because the modifiers are going to be so good.
You're allocating where you're putting districts based on this as well.
You've got a city that you made that was close to either a lot of rainforest or a lot of mountains, which is both good for campus adjacency. So you might prioritize getting the campus there before you even did like an encampment or the gold place, depending on if it was forward towards an AI, you might want the encampment. But it's easier to place like the market district type of thing. I'm calling it that. It's a different name, but because there's a lot of adjacency on rivers and things. Commercial hub, thank you. I don't know names today.
Harbors are good for money, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to be directly on the coast, so you can't get attacked by ships so easily, but being just one tile off, and this is one of those things that comes from the earlier games. It feels so counterintuitive to not be on the coast, but one tile off is actually better, because you can still place the harbor, and yet they can't overrun you with boats.
Not until later in the games when they have battleships and stuff like that can bombard your city real quickly.
But they still have to land something.
Still an advantage, though.
Yeah,
it still reduces the number of ships that can whale on your city, even in the late game. Because if you're on the coast and you have three ranged ships, they can stack up like 6+ ships and have all of them shoot your city.
Right.
Whereas if you're inland by a little bit more than that, you're probably only getting shot by 3 battleships. That still sucks, but
it's a lot less than if you could literally put it on the coast and they could just run up an ironclad to take your city.
Oh yeah, that's true as well. They can't just take your city with a melee ship. They'll have to, at minimum, land a unit to take the city, even if they do blow it to pieces. So there are some advantages, no matter what, to not being on the coast, but still having access to naval stuff.
Yeah. Each of your cities, as you place them and build them, you're sort of trying to think in the back of your head what districts are going to be good in this city, because you can't build every district in every city. You have to specialize them a little bit.
And
quite a bit.
The number of districts that you can build is locked by the population of the city. So you have to reach certain population thresholds before you're allowed to build another district. Like the second district you can't build until you have, 4 population? So you also need to make sure that your city can grow to those sizes if you want to build all of those districts, because otherwise you will just not be allowed to. Do we actually think we want to go through all the districts and like what they do and how to get adjacency bonuses, or is that like too much minutiae?
I think that would be better
to look up on the wiki as someone learning is playing, rather than trying to listen to us now and hold all that memory.
Yeah, all the memory. Yeah.
This is a brief explanation as opposed to a detailed. So, the most important thing about districts is never build a neighborhood.
Wait, hold up. Right in the game, that's actually great for getting more housing when you don't have a lot of space. And the Zulu actually have, I think it's the Zulu, have a special district that they get really early that is a neighborhood.
Not too common to see good players build neighborhoods.
The reason you don't build neighborhoods is because the AI recruits partisans, which are bad.
Oh.
That's one of several reasons.
Yes, also, that 1 or 2 per city I might build as Congo is really going to be a bad thing later.
Congo
is a little bit different because they get them earlier. But there's a couple things going against neighborhoods. And this goes into our strategy and what kind of game we're trying to win too. So I guess it's worth mentioning. So as cities grow, it becomes increasingly expensive food-wise to grow further. So even if you have neighborhoods, it's going to take you ages to grow from like pop 19 to 20, for example. And what is the marginal value of that 20th pop? What is it doing in that city that makes it worth the growth? Because in Civ 6, you don't have the same kind of value from specialists as you would from earlier games.
Yeah, if specialists could generate great people points, that might change that dynamic a whole lot.
In previous games, yes. But now, no. And so what's your 20th best tile in the city? It's probably not that good. Not too many cities can slash should have guaranteed so like 15 plus good tiles. So you're spending a lot to grow onto something very marginal as opposed to just producing something else including just skipping the neighborhood in the first place and getting more value out of it.
I was mostly making a joke, but okay, that's all true.
I don't want to say never do this, but it's true that you don't see a lot of neighborhoods out of the really fast space win games or people who just conquer the world quickly. I don't know about culture. I don't really do culture a whole lot. But you just like in effective play, they don't show up a lot. And it's not just because of partisans, although, yes, the extra annoyance factor does not make them more attractive to me, despite their inefficiencies, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of the times where I've ended up playing them, building them is I'd made worse decisions earlier about what to build, and I just needed a little bit of extra elbow room. Like maybe I only need 1 or 2 of that capacity for a neighborhood, or you have something like it's where you're Australia and they have that bonus to things because of the beauty on the tile, and it's like, oh, I can have a +8 housing tile, just this one tile. I mean, great, my housing problems are solved for the rest of the game.
Yeah, I don't want to say never do it.
Yeah, there's always exceptions depending on the map circumstances and the specific civilization you've chosen. So everything we're talking about is just general guidelines. Like, all of it is subject to change depending on the conditions of your game.
Yeah, somebody here has an entire website breaking down each civ for you.
Well, not all of them.
Well, a lot of them.
I'm working on it. If you are looking for guides for specific civs, I have written a series of strategy guides at my personal blog at www.megabearsfan.net. I hope you check them out and that they prove helpful to you. I've got something like, I think, 20 guides written currently. So thank you, Mackie, for the shameless self-promotion.
Well, you know, considering it is very helpful, you know, we've even gone through, I mean, even before you were a co-host, we had you on sometimes, but sometimes we just go through the articles on your blog when we were still doing Civ 5 stuff. So, you know.
And there are lots of other guides, too. There's not just mine. I know there's a user on Steam named Zigzag Zigal. I'm not sure how exactly to pronounce that. That user produces some pretty detailed guides that talk about all of the uniques of the civilization and how to use each of them. And then, you know, some general tips and some more specific tips for each victory type and all that stuff. So, you know, there's plenty of good guides around for you to find if you look for them.
Definitely useful. All right, now for the big one, war and fighting.
Where to start? Woohoo!
Where do we start? Maybe the basics of the combat rules?
Maybe we should start with the warning that if you be careful how you declare war and when and on who, because the civs do have a problem with you if you start killing people. They will get angry.
And the specific mechanics for that change depending on whether or not you have the expansion packs. Do we want to talk about Warmonger in the vanilla game, or do we want to talk about grievances? Should we save grievances for a later episode when we talk more specifically about the expansion?
I think we should talk about the grievance system.
AI just does so little with it. Like, it's worth considering because it will have an impact on your ability to, like, say, make alliances and get yields that way. But coordinated attacks from the AI as a response to player aggression are flimsy at best, even on the highest difficulties. It's usually not a significant threat. So,
if you're going to be playing a military victory where you're going to be conquering everybody anyway, you really don't need to worry at all about what the other AIs think of you because you're going to kill them all anyway. But if you're playing a more peaceful strategy, you know, or you're just learning the game and you don't want the AIs constantly attacking you, you definitely want to consider the warmonger or grievance system when you're declaring war or reacting to a war.
Yeah, the AI has some convoluted logic when it comes to how it evaluates wars.
But I guess the basic gist of it is that whenever you declare war on another civilization, or you capture cities, or you capture their capital, or you wipe another civilization off the face of the planet, you're going to generate either warmonger points if you're in vanilla, or you're going to generate grievances if you're in, were grievances added in Gathering Storm, or was it Rise and Fall? I want to say Gathering Storm.
Gathering Storm, I think.
But they function similarly, which is that basically it's going to act as a diplomatic modifier that will basically make every other civilization in the game hate you. And in the course of Warmonger score in vanilla, that lasts for pretty much the entire rest of the game. And if you do that enough and get enough Warmonger score, you will never be able to recover from that diplomatically. So you definitely want to be careful early in the game about who you're picking fights with and how you're resolving those conflicts.
I believe it did decay. It was just not fast enough where if you accrued a ton of it, it would be gone in any meaningful amount of time.
Yeah, it decayed faster in the earlier in the game. So like if you declared wars in the ancient era, I think that warmonger score would decay within like an era or two, so that by like the medieval era, you're fine again. But the wars that you're declaring in like the Renaissance, like you're not getting rid of that warmonger score ever for the rest of the game.
Yeah, probably not. Not by the time a game would normally end anyway.
And yeah, that will affect your ability to trade with the AIs, because the less the AIs like you, the less they're willing to give you in trade. It'll affect your ability to have friendships, to make alliances, to declare joint wars and get help against other civs, which, you know, especially for a new player, like having the support of the other AIs in a conflict can really make or break a game when you're learning the game. So, you know, you definitely do want to try to have a hard picture. and it's also
AI is pretty bad.
Well,
at moving units and fighting.
From my experience, is it's not necessarily the AI going in and fighting, but it's the AI just basically giving your target another target to worry about, especially if they're coming on a different front. Because it means that, you know, that other civ has to possibly split its forces up between two different fronts, and that will make it easier for you on your front, even if your AI companion is just getting their butts kicked on the other front.
It's called a meat shield.
Now, there's one thing I want to say here, because so far we've made it sound like going to war is negative. These penalties are put in place because it is by far one of the most effective ways to expand your empire and secure a winning position with the alternative choices not even being close. And to the extent that these penalties really aren't much of a deterrent in practice, if you can conquer like 6 to 10 AI cities and you're just trying to win the game, that's what you're caring about, you should conquer those cities. Generally, any value you've lost from diplomacy or threat of other AIs is trivial compared to the value of just expanding your empire that way.
That's true.
And but if they hate you, just take their cities too. So you will eventually win if you keep doing it.
But if you are
and
a new player,
you will get stronger and stronger.
If you are a new player and you just you don't understand why none of the AIs will trade with you, it's probably because of this.
This is one way, yes. If you conquer nations, they don't like you. And that's fair. Even in PvP, like if somebody's conquering a lot of cities for different reasons, everyone else is going to get a little nervous because this does increase your strength so much that you become more of a threat to win. So even human players will take it seriously, albeit for different reasons than the AI. But that just goes to show how strong it is to do, how valuable it is to do if you can do it.
Which, again, is one of the reasons that we recommended building a lot of military units early in the game to deal with the barbarians. Because now when you start to get into war with the other civilizations, you'll kind of reap the rewards of having those units because you've already built them. So you don't need to spend production on them now. As you learn new technologies, you don't have to build new units from scratch. You can upgrade your existing units with gold, and war is a very good way usually to get gold, because you're pillaging tiles or plundering trade routes and stuff like that.
Science too.
Yeah, and science. Mm-hmm. So yeah, having a sizable army earlier in the game, even if it was just for dealing with barbs, will be beneficial to you in the middle parts of the game and later in the game when you are using that army either to defend yourself or to conquer another civilization.
And all that experience they've gained, especially when you've got like archer units that you've promoted a few times, and now they've got like multiple attacks per turn to help wear down like a city a lot faster. And they gain that from fighting barbs, you know.
I would recommend that you do make an effort to try to protect your well-promoted units, because losing a unit with like getting the first one or two promotions generally is pretty quick and easy. But when you've got a unit with 3 promotions or 4 promotions, if you lose that unit, oh man, that is nasty.
It hurts, yeah. And generally speaking, although it has improved a little bit since vanilla, most of the time when you're fighting an AI in a war, it's possible to avoid losing units, like at all.
And we've seen times where we totally think we're going to lose it, and then the AI just doesn't shoot that unit, and then you're like, what?
Oh, it's getting a little bit better about that now. But I would say if you're losing units, it's worth thinking about some practice so that you don't lose units. Because most of the time, it's possible to avoid losing military when fighting AI. Not always, but most of the time you can avoid it.
And if you need more practice, you can also go into a hot seat game like against yourself and just build a bunch of units on both sides on like a tiny dual map or whatever, and just like, you know, practice things like sieging cities and zone of control so that you can see in a controlled environment how that stuff works, because understanding those rules is very important to military success in Civilization VI.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about zone of control?
If you want to go for it.
Basically, if you move next to an adjacent unit, you have to attack it or stay where you are.
But some units ignore zone of control, and some units by default don't create zone of control.
Right.
Archers don't typically exert zone of control, and frequently the mounted line will not be affected by zone of control.
And this combined with the you know, cost of moving onto tiles in Civ 6 really can slow down the movement of your armies. If the opponent just puts like a few units in your way, like it can really slow you down.
Note that defensively, especially in high levels, this is crucial for protecting your city. If you put units that are fortified near your city, the AI will struggle to move into range of the city, which means your archer and the city, and if you built them walls, will get free hits on the units as they attempt it. But also that they can't put your city under siege, which would otherwise prevent it from healing every turn. And they also just can't attack it with as many units until they deal with your units. They have to get your units out of the way, or they can only attack from like one or two spots against the city. So this is a very good defensive resource, zone of control, because you can force the AI to either attack you or to move very slowly and be ineffectual as it tries to approach something other than the unit that's defending. Positioning for zone of control and then try not to get yourself surrounded by three or more units, because that allows relatively similarly strength units to focus you down and kill your units, which you want to avoid. But it's possible to kill way more troops than you lose on the defensive against the AI if you're willing to rotate units and you have them positioned well.
Okay. Well, it looks like we have reached the point where we need to consider wrapping up for this episode and possibly coming back for a later one. Is there anything critically important that we haven't said that beginners need to know?
One thing that I remember going back to districts is a very good tip. It's, I guess, kind of an intermediate to advanced tip, but you should probably get used to doing it earlier rather than sooner, is the cost of districts increase as the game goes on, as you develop more technologies and build more districts. But if you place the district down on a tile, it locks in the cost of that district. And so it's a very common strategy for good players, even if you're not going to build the district right now, just to place it on the map early so that it locks in that cheaper cost before you research more techs or anything like that, and the cost of that district goes up.
I'm going to step back from the weeds for a bit and just emphasize, because it's still true in Civ 6, it just as it is in every 4X previously, you want to increase your empire's output as much as possible, as quickly as possible. And in the vast majority of cases, that should be guiding your decision-making throughout the game. That is your overarching focus to being in an effective position in 4X in general and in Civ 6. So if you are uncertain of what to do in the moment, start thinking about what gets you there.
I think this is all very good advice. All right, well, in that case, it's time for me to be more prepared than I currently am, apparently. Let's see if I can spell this right. Apparently not, because I forgot the space. Oh, I didn't assign anybody to do the outro this time, did I?
Nope.
Okay, let's see. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, blah, 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 blah. We'll say, how about you do it, Mega Bears fan.
Awesome. What episode number was this again?
351.
All right. Thank you, Internet, for listening to Polycast episode 351. I have been your regular co-host, Mega Bears fan, along with Canis Albinus.
Everybody have a Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a Good New Year.
Makalua.
Also have a happy Suvmas playing.
And the Mian team.
Soon you too can have hundreds of horsemen running through enemy territory.
As long as they're healthy horsemen, I don't care.
Well, of course they are, because they're eating all the enemy crops as they pillage everything.
Well, that may not make them healthy, but too much green makes horses sick.
Oh, well, it's not just green. There are other colors, too.
Yeah, they're getting smart eating all the books.
Oh, dear. Oh, my goodness.
Horses? That's not what I've had in mind, but it's funny.
I was going to say, horses eating paper may also not be a good idea.
Oh, I forgot. It's not goat cavalry.
It's okay. They can survive on the blood of our enemies.
I think that would make a horse sick, actually.
That would make most things sick.
Not pigs.
Not everything, not but pigs. Most things.
Pigs can eat the blood of their enemies.
Nice. Unfortunately, I don't know how to make pig cavalry units.
I don't think anybody does.
Because it does sound pretty horrifying. Send that through enemy territory.
Civilization 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.